This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I'm going to try and connect for you some of the research that I've done over the last 5 or 6 years looking at autism policy and services and treatment, sometimes from the 1,000-foot view, sometimes much more granularly. I love word clouds. I just took the text from my last 4 or 5 grants and stuck them into a word cloud program online just because, you know, it's like, well, what do I study? And it turns out this is what I study. So I'm a big believer of keeping text off of slides, and I want to make one exception though, and I'll tell you why in a minute. A couple of years ago, we were asked to go into a state psychiatric hospital in Philadelphia, or just outside Philadelphia, because the state's Bureau of Autism Services was sure that there was a lot of undiagnosed autism among the chronically mentally ill who were in these hospitals. And I was very skeptical, but we did it anyway. And so we went into one state psychiatric hospital, and we actually found that about 10% of people, most of whom were diagnosed with chronic undifferentiated schizophrenia, met research criteria for autism. And that's hard to figure out, right? These are guys who have often been in these hospitals for decades. They're heavily medded up, so it's difficult to do a clinical interview. And it's often very hard to get a developmental history, except, ironically, for the people who had been there the longest, the people who had been institutionalized for before DSM-3, before 1980, had these beautiful, long clinical notes. And we would go and get their charts, and there were boxes and boxes of charts for some of these folks. And this is from the early notes from one of the patients we met there, BP. BP, we actually found BP's mother. BP was 62 years old, and his mother was 92. And we did an ADI with his mother, which was an extraordinarily moving experience. This is a woman who, when her son was 8 years old, was very concerned and went down from Philadelphia to Baltimore to meet with a psychiatrist there because she didn't know what to do about her son. He was having a lot of trouble in school. His pediatrician thought that he was retarded, was the language that was used, and that they suggested that they put him in an institution. And his mother just refused to do this and brought him down to meet with another psychiatrist, hoping that psychiatrist would help. He was in a special school in Philadelphia. And, you know, years before Skinner, we're talking about, we have a teacher who originated a behavior chart for him, and that he appeared to enjoy working for rewards. I mean, this is phenomenally creative people who have been working in this field for longer than we realize. He stimmed a lot. He was echolalic. This was a guy with autism, and this was the person to go to find out. So this was, I would estimate, one of the first 100 or 150 people diagnosed with autism ever in the world. And he was diagnosed by Leo Kanner in 1954 with autism. Leo Kanner writes this beautiful, sensitive note about this child, but still suggests that his psychosis is going to increase, and he will become increasingly difficult to handle. And that his parents have two options. One is to put him in one of Pennsylvania's many fine psychiatric hospitals, and the other is to put him with what Dr. Kanner refers to as a dog patch family. So this is a rural family who would not be concerned with social niceties. And he also sends them to a support group. Apparently there's a support group for parents of children with autism in the mid-50s. The closest one is in New York City. So the mother refuses to do this. She keeps her son at home, and they have a second child. And the daughter, the boy becomes increasingly aggressive towards his sister. And finally, feeling like she has no choice, she institutionalizes him. And this is where she puts him. She puts him in Norristown State Psychiatric Hospital. And there was a time when we were so proud of our state psychiatric hospitals that we put them on postcards. These are postcards you can buy off eBay of state psychiatric hospitals from around the country. And this is what they looked like. And you have to remember, in 1955, it was the height of our institutionalization of people in the U.S. There are 100 million people living in the United States, and in any given year, 550,000 of them are institutionalized for some period of time. This was our primary mode of treatment for individuals with psychiatric disorders. The problem is, this is what they look like now. So when we went to the state psychiatric hospital to assess these folks, this is where they are. And we have been closing them since the early 1970s, but many of them still exist around the country. And where it turns out, at least from our assessment, that many people, many adults with undiagnosed autism are getting care. So we begin to think, well, that was the 1950s, and things are getting better. But the problem is that they're not. In many ways, they are getting much better. Things are much better for people with autism now than they were in the 1950s. But we are still hospitalizing and institutionalizing a large number of people with autism. And so we did a survey of 1,000 families in Pennsylvania. And one of the things we asked was your child ever psychiatrically hospitalized? And at what age were they hospitalized if they were? And these are kids who were born between 1983 and 1994. And you can see that by age 21, almost 40% of them have been psychiatrically hospitalized at least once. And then we looked at kids born between 1994 and 1999, and we only had data to 2009 at this point. But what you see is that for these young kids, the rate of hospitalization is actually higher than it was before, than for the kids who were born earlier. And so our estimate is we are actually hospitalizing kids at a greater rate than we used to. Now, sometimes hospitalization is warranted. Sometimes there are children whose difficulties are so impairing and who are such a danger to themselves or others that our best bet is to take them out of their communities, at least for a brief stint. I would argue that most of the time when we hospitalize or institutionalize children, it represents a failure of our community to be able to care for them properly. And this actually takes me to something I have to thank one of your faculty for, Peter Mundy. So when I was a postdoc, I went to my first IMFAR conference in 2001, the International Meeting for Autism Research, and Peter was talking about screening, and he said, you know, we are diagnosing more and more kids with autism, and the communities in which we're diagnosing them are completely unprepared to meet their needs. And I thought, that's what I want to do. And so I think about that as sort of the crystallization of my career, and that's sort of what I think about most of the time. What do we as a society, what do we as a community do about these kids who are identifying an increasing number? And we really are identifying them in increasing numbers. So, you know, 1990 was when we reauthorized what used to be called the Education of All Handicapped Children Act, and we reauthorized it as the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And autism, for the first time, was a category of special education, and it's the first time we started to have an administrative count of the number of kids with autism. So let's wash out the first couple of years, because it took some states a while to get on board with doing that. And in 1993, you have 23,000 children in the U.S. in the special education system. And the last time we counted, 2012, it's almost 500,000 children. And not only is the absolute number growing, but they are growing as a proportion of all children in special education. So about 15 years ago, they comprised less than 1% of all children in special education, and now they're reaching 8% of all children in special education. So we really have identified them in increasing numbers. And one of the challenges with that is that it is very expensive to care for these kids, certainly the way that we care for them now, and also there's a cost associated with not caring for them that gets merged into this. And so we were asked by Autism Speaks a couple of years ago to come up with an estimate of what the annual cost of autism was in the United States. And our estimate was that it was about $137 billion a year. And that's for the services we provide to children with autism in the education system, in the healthcare system. It's also for indirect costs, things like lost wages to families, or opportunity costs for those individuals who then are not going on to who have autism and are not going on to work in our society. So if you think about this within the context of other diseases, well, we won't call live birth a disease, right? But it costs something to be born, it turns out, right? And so that's about $37 billion a year. But if we look at these other conditions, cardiovascular conditions, cancer, injury, and poisoning, those three have substantially higher costs associated with them than autism, but then comes autism, which is higher than diseases like diabetes, than asthma, than other psychiatric disorders combined. So this is a huge number. And this is where a lot of those costs are. And they are, in some ways, where you would expect. So for very young children, where the expenses are in special education and early intervention system. And then as they age, what you see is that those change until when they get to be adults, where the largest expenditures are is in residential care. So again, we are institutionalizing folks for whom, some of whom it may be a good option. But again, I would argue often it's because we fail to have other options for them. Right? And we often talk about the healthcare system and we talk about the education system, and those are in many ways, in addition to the family, the major systems that care for kids with autism. But when we conceptualize a system of care for children with autism and we think about the places where their lives touch or intersect, there are many more places than that. At, I would call the bedrock of it, the family, obviously. You have parents and then you have SIBs, if they are lucky, right? You have the education system, which starts with early intervention, goes on to the education system, and then the Rehabilitation and Services Administration. One of the things I would point out is there are relatively few studies of the experiences of adults with autism in vocational rehabilitation. The ones that do exist show that while they are very expensive to care for in that system and to train in that system, their vocational outcomes are at least as good, if not better, than many of the other people who are served in that administration. So I think we could do it more efficiently, but there really are things that we can do to help adults in this system. You have medical care, both private and public, and intersecting with that is the mental health care system, and especially as adults, as individuals with autism age, that becomes, in many ways, their primary care site, their primary home site, especially for those who are publicly insured, and then you have issues of housing. And when we think about a system of care for people with autism, we tend to focus here. And maybe a little bit here. I would argue that we need to broaden our focus much more. Having said that, I'm going to look where the light is today and talk a bit about these systems, education and healthcare. So we as a society have made a decision that we need to do a better job of increasing access to care for individuals with autism. And one of the ways we've done that is legislatively. And so many states right now, it's 34 states, I think, have passed autism insurance mandates or in the process of passing autism insurance mandates. And these mandates require that commercial insurance products cover autism services. And they vary across states, but in general, they tend to require intensive behavioral health care for children with autism. Sometimes they're very restricted. So in Texas, it's for children less than 6 years of age. In other places like South Carolina, it goes up through age 21, and it's whatever a physician deems is medically necessary. And so there's some considerable variability. The initial data coming back on these mandates does not suggest that they are effective in improving access to care or satisfaction with care. Right. So the green states are states that have passed autism insurance mandates. The blue states and yellow states are on their way, and the red states, and I did not pick these colors, the red states are the ones that that are not considering a mandate at this time. When you think about commercial insurance means that you have insurance through your employer. And it also means that you have an employer who has more than 50 employees. Right? Because these laws do not apply to very small businesses, and they also don't apply to self-insured companies. Right? And some of those self-insured companies have taken it upon themselves to have mandates that match those, benefits that match those of the mandates, like Home Depot or Discovery, but others have not. And so we estimate that these mandates affect about 37% of all children with autism. So part of the reason we may not be seeing a shift in access to care or in satisfaction with care is because it's only about a third of the kids. Much more important to my mind, but often overlooked, is Medicaid. So many states have expanded Medicaid coverage, and this March, most states will have expanded Medicaid coverage because of the Affordable Care Act to cover children with autism. 9 states have autism waivers, that is, they've expanded eligibility of children in their state, or they've expanded the services that are available to those children through their Medicaid program. Another 30 or so states have waivers that cover children with autism, even though it's not specific to autism. So a waiver means that a state says, there's a group of kids who are in danger of being institutionalized, and certainly this group is in danger of being institutionalized. And unless we provide a specific service to them, or unless we expand care to kids who otherwise wouldn't be eligible for Medicaid, they're going to end up in the hospital. They're going to end up in residential care. And so those states are using Medicaid dollars to pay for care for children with autism. Pennsylvania, in fact, has one of the most generous Medicaid policies in that almost by virtue of diagnosis, children with autism are eligible for Medicaid reimbursed services. And the treated prevalence and the proportion of children with autism covered by Medicaid is really rising dramatically. Unfortunately, I only have data till 2005, but when I call the Center for Medicaid Services and ask them about it, it turns out that this line continues to rise. And we estimate that about half of kids with autism are served through the Medicaid system. And so we think that both systems, both commercial insurance and public insurance, are very important places for us to target and to pay attention to. The other thing about Medicaid is these are the kids who are in poverty, right? And so these are kids for whom other insurance options aren't available. They're also kids who tend to be overlooked by this system. And we know that these children are diagnosed later and receive less satisfactory treatment than wealthier children. And in Medicaid, we pay more for kids with autism. So this is average outpatient Medicaid expenditures for children with autism using 2005 data, and this is from private insurance. So a multiplier of 5 for what we spend in Medicaid versus what we spend in private insurance. And what's interesting is when you look at inpatient expenditures and look at medications, there's not much of a difference. That what we are getting through the Medicaid system is much greater access to outpatient services, in large part because of the generosity of Medicaid systems that isn't on the commercial side. And when people are thinking about mandates, as you think about your mandate, as you think about Medicaid expansion, one of the big issues for you to consider and for all states to consider is how do we make sure that by implementing a mandate, we don't unintentionally make things worse for families who already had Medicaid coverage? Right? And how do we think about making sure that those commercial benefits are as generous and as available as the public benefits are? So one of the things, I mentioned the waivers. And so the purpose of the waiver is to keep kids out of institutions. And one of the things we wanted to see is, well, are they actually doing what they said they're supposed to do? And so I have a very enterprising health economist, Zuleha Sadab, who knew nothing about autism before she came and joined us and has just been a force of nature in taking an economist lens to thinking about these issues related to autism. And one of the thing. So she looked at kids who are on the waiver, and she looked at kids who were in disability and kids who had a inpatient stay or in long-term care. It's hard to figure out who to compare these kids. We don't get to randomize them to the waiver or not waiver, much as I'd like to. I wouldn't like to. But so we did 2 comparison groups, and what we found is that kids who were receiving waiver services were much less likely to be hospitalized or be in long-term care than kids on disability. They also got a lot more outpatient care, which is what we hope would happen, which suggests that the waivers are fulfilling their function. They were not cost-effective. That is, that we were spending more on kids in the waiver than we were on kids on disability or who received inpatient care overall. And so this leads me to one of my soapboxes. And the soapbox is about the danger of economic evaluation. right? And so now, remember, these are only costs within the healthcare system. There are lots of other health costs, education costs, indirect family costs that we could add to this, and maybe these numbers would start to look a little different. But I think it's very important to remember that the issue here is not which costs less. The issue is what do we value as a society? And where are we going to put our funds? And so I'm going to show you some slides later that suggest that, for example, good early intervention is cost effective. But I don't think that's the metric we should be using to think about these policy and service decisions. I'm going to show you more slides about it, even having said that. So one of the things we also got interested in is, well, what about states who are spending more on the waiver or less on the waiver? Like, is this an issue of not going in with both feet? Right? If you really committed to the waiver, would you see better financial outcomes? And it turns out that depends on what you compare it with. So these are kids who had an inpatient stay, right? And it turns out that think of this as the difference in expenditure. I wanted to know, I asked Zuleha, why can't I just put dollars here? Why can't I show dollars on the y-axis? And she was at home, so she couldn't tell me. So she wrote 2 pages of mathematical formulas. And she then took pictures of them and emailed them to me and said, this is why. And I really didn't have a response to that. There was nothing I could do. But think about this. So when this is negative, it means we're spending less money on kids in the waiver than we are for the other groups. And when it's positive, it means we're spending more money on kids in the waiver than in the other groups. So for this orange line, when we compare them to kids who had an inpatient stay, even spending just a very little money on the waiver results in cost saving in the waiver. Right? And as you spend more money, you actually start to lose money, and that you're spending more money on the waiver than you would if those kids were hospitalized. That's a way to think about it. And so for this blue line is comparing them to kids on disability. And it turns out that there's a break-even point, that when you are spending $5,400 per month per kid on the waiver, you actually start to save money on the waiver. So one of the issues with these waivers is that when this is why we wanted to do this study, when a state proposes to the Center for Medicaid Services, we want to have a waiver, the Center for Medicaid Services says, okay, but whatever you say you're going to do on this waiver, you have to do it. It's like it became part of your state plan. You're legally obligated to provide these services. And so states get very nervous about this. And so, for example, when Colorado implemented a Medicaid waiver, they started with 75 kids. Right? Let's just do it for a few kids and see what happens. Right? Well, if you do it for a few kids and see what happens and you do an economic evaluation, it's going to look like you lost money. Right? And so part of what makes the waivers effective seems to be the scale, or as I like to say, go big or go home. Right? So part of when we think about these economic evaluations, that scale also becomes important. Right? So what is it about the waivers that's important? Right? Waivers is just making money available for services or making certain kinds of services available. One of the things we wanted to know is what are the services that actually keep kids out of the hospital? And so we started to look at individual services. We use Medicaid claims for this. So these are billing data. This is like we know 5 things about 26 million kids. Right? And so it's how many ways can we slice these 5 different things? But we do know what services they got. And so one of the things we can look at is we broke these services into respite service use and what we call therapeutic service use. So these are functional therapies like physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, when a state specified behavioral treatment or mental health care, we put it into that list. We tried looking at the individual services. We tried lumping the services together in different ways. And these are other outpatient services that we don't think have a real therapeutic value. Things like transportation or durable goods or things like that. And what you find is what's associated with reduction in hospitalization is respite services, not therapeutic services. Now, there are a lot of problems with this. There's something that we call a selection bias, right? Because kids who are more severely impaired are probably going to get more services. And kids who get more services or are more severely impaired are also more likely to end up in the hospital, right? So we take these with a grain of salt. But if that's true, how come we see different numbers for respite service use versus therapeutic service use? So these are odds ratios, which means that if it's less than one, you're less likely to be hospitalized. And if it's more than one, you're more likely to be hospitalized. And these numbers were not statistically significant. But, you know, boys got more, you know, other things go in the direction we expect them to. Boys get more, are more likely to be hospitalized. Older kids are more likely to be hospitalized. Kids in foster care are the most likely to be hospitalized. Those things are all going the right direction. Why isn't therapeutic service use going in the right direction? This is 135,000 kids with autism who are diagnosed with autism in the Medicaid system. And we require that they have at least one inpatient diagnosis or two outpatient diagnoses, which has been validated as having a very high positive predictive value. So this is exciting. It means we should provide respite. So if you are involved in policymaking in your state or thinking about what services are important to cover, clearly respite is an important one. And it's important because it keeps kids out of the hospital. It's important for a lot of reasons. It's important for family functioning. But here we are able to sort of put a dollar amount on it, which is a metric I think that people understand. So why not therapeutic services? Right? And so the more we think about this, the more it leads us to think that maybe therapeutic services aren't doing what we want them to do in the community. Right? Or the things that we call therapeutic services are maybe not as therapeutic as we might hope. And this has led us, my research group, to a big shift, a shift from thinking about the 1,000-foot view, how do we evaluate these policies on a national level, to a more granular view of what is actually going on in these communities. When we say a kid is getting X, is getting ABA-based intervention, or getting speech therapy, or getting occupational therapy, what does that really mean when we go into the community and look? And this is really important because we know that there are interventions that we can deliver, like this one, right, that result in really positive outcomes for kids. That if we can identify these kids early and we get them in to university-based research trials, you can see profound changes in cognition and profound changes in adaptive behavior relative to a control group. Right? And again, to put a dollar stamp on it, it turns out it's cost effective, right? So partnering with the folks who did that first Early Start Denver model trial, we took their data. They collected data on kids on what services they received. And this is the intervention that they received. So this is years from start of intervention. And you can see that the expense of the intervention is much greater than the expense of the services that kids received in community service. So that by the end of the intervention period, these guys had received almost $230,000 worth of care, and these guys had received about $130,000 worth of care. And we always talk, when you read studies that do simulations of return on investment, of why it's important to invest in early intervention, they often talk about the gains reaped in adulthood, right? Our data suggests that by the time they hit high school, you're making your money back, right? So that if we can implement early intervention the way that it was designed, that it can be very cost effective. The problem is that we know that the intervention that gets delivered in the community looks nothing like those interventions on the whole. There are notable, wonderful exceptions, and your children go there. But in many, many places, so I'm in Philadelphia, and you look at many urban settings, that's not happens. And so why this disparity between what we know could happen, what we know is possible, and what we know is probable? Right? And one way to think about this is in the context of the difference between efficacy and effectiveness. So efficacy is, does an intervention work under ideal circumstances? So what are ideal circumstances? Well, I got a grant, right? And so the federal government or a foundation has given me money that allows me to implement the intervention the way it was designed. And I have highly trained and supervised treatment. Why? Because they're all my graduate students, or they're all my staff, and they're all a little afraid of me, and they're going to do exactly what I say, right? And they're all highly motivated, and that's why they're in graduate school, because they're going on to bigger, better things. And I get restrictive inclusion and exclusion criteria. And this is certainly not true of every intervention, but it's perfectly reasonable for me to specify that I will only take children with a mental age of 18 months who have no self-injurious behaviors and are potty trained, right? And so it turns out that you're not allowed to do that as a kindergarten teacher, right? So, and so the kids who are in these studies sometimes do not look like the kids who are in practice. There's highly variable training and motivation. And I'll talk a little bit about why in a minute, but think of you are a public school teacher working with kids with autism, and this year they tell you, we are going to do the new thing. And so you invest heavily in that new thing, and then a new administration arises. And they say, you know, now we're doing the new thing. And you say, yeah, but okay. And you start doing the new thing. And by the time the new thing rolls around, you're kind of done. And you think, you know, I'll wait, right? And you have a principal who doesn't understand you, and you have a small room, and because it used to be a closet, because the school didn't really want an autism classroom, so that's what the principal gave you. And you have a classroom assistant who you don't get along with so well. In fact, we've often thought that if we could just offer couples therapy to teachers and classroom assistants, that we would do we would improve autism outcomes, right? And so you've got that high variability, and that's due to those changes in programmatic priorities. It's also due. Sally and I were having a really important but dispiriting conversation about pre-service training and what that means for autism intervention. And so, to the extent that we think about how things work in the real world, we think about effectiveness instead of efficacy. And in almost every study that's ever done about any psychosocial intervention, there is a drop in the outcomes between efficacy and effectiveness. And my research has become about, how do we stop that drop, right? How do we make things as effective as they are efficacious, right? And so this is part of the problem. So I consult for some school districts. This is not a school district in Pennsylvania or in California. And the first thing I ask them is, well, what do you do? Tell me the interventions you do. And so this is a list from one school district. I will not read this list to you. You can read this list yourself. This is a lot of stuff. Some of these things are contraindicated. Some of these things are really complicated, some less so. My favorite part is these strategies are used across all settings, ages, and grades based on the individual needs of the students. Well, these are not appropriate for all settings, ages, and grades. And it would be impossible. Well, I'm sure there's someone out there who could do it. But for most people, it would be impossible to be expert in all these things. And so I think a big part of what we are doing is training people to be mediocre in a lot of things, right? And so part of, and this is especially important in large school districts. This is you. You are number 98 out of the 100 largest school districts in the United States, right? So why are the 100 largest school districts really important? Oh, and you have a lot in California in general. Right? They're important because they are often under-resourced, underfunded. They are cobbling together resources from multiple places. They are besieged by problems aside from the sort of educational needs of their students, but the challenges their families face, the challenges of their social environment. For many families, autism is the least of their worries. And yet, there are 18,000 school districts in the United States. So the top 100 in size comprise 0.6% of all school districts, and they serve 23% of all children. Right? If you could change things in just these 100 out of 18,000 places, you could make a disproportionately huge difference in the lives of many, many children with autism. And so a lot of what I've started to think about is what the challenges are that these large school districts face. Incidentally, Philadelphia over here, we're number 8. All right, so what did we do? So we started partnering with the school district in 2007. We got very interested in how do you improve quality of care in these classrooms. And a big part of the challenge, and here's my first sneaky trick, is that if you're going to partner with these community organizations and with school districts, the problem you're addressing has to come from them and not from you. Right? And so what's the problem they want to address? Well, Pennsylvania doesn't have kindergarten. Mandatory kindergarten, because we are a medieval state. And so so kids can take an extra year of early intervention when they want. And every time a kid takes an extra year of early intervention, at the volition of the parent, the funding source switches to the district, and the district is now paying $30,000 to $50,000 for this kid. And our district wanted to figure out how to get families to feel more comfortable making the transition to kindergarten. Right? And so we spent a lot of time looking at the process. You could not design a process if you tried that would inculcate more anxiety in parents than the one that we have. I won't go into detail about it, but a big part of it was they couldn't articulate what it was that was offered in kindergarten. There was not a specific program that families could feel comfortable that they were getting for their kid that was evidence-based and that was carefully monitored and that they would understand the progress of their child. And so to address this, we partnered with them and applied to the Institute of Education Sciences and NIH to do a randomized trial, because that's how I know how to do these things. So we took two classroom-based interventions that they chose. One was called Strategies for Teaching Based on Autism Research, which combines functional routines with discrete trial training and pivotal response training and a very pretty 159 lesson plan curriculum. And the other was TEACH, which is the educational strategy that was developed out of Division TEACH in North Carolina. They actually, while epistemologically they are very different in some ways, when you actually see them in practice, it's remarkable how similar some of the components are. And that's one of the things I've had to learn as I've moved from the 1,000-foot view to like the 50-foot view, is they call these things different names. They argue a lot about the nuanced differences, and then when you see them in action in the community, I can't tell. I'll tell you one of my favorite stories. And so I was interviewing a psychologist for a job, and she had trained with the Kegels in PRT. And then she went and did an internship with Stanley Greenspan in floor time. And so one time, she was very versatile. And so she was doing floor time with a family while Greenspan was watching through the observational window. And as she says, you know, just for kicks, I'm going to do PRT. So she did straight up PRT with this kid while Greenspan was watching. And the family leaves. They thank her. She thanks them. They leave. Greenspan comes into the room. He puts his hand on her shoulder. He shakes his head. And he says, Danielle, that was beautiful floor time. That you know, ontologically, the differences among these things sometimes are not so clear. Anyway, so that was a very long way of saying that. So we randomized teachers to receive training in STAR or structured teaching. We provided them a lot of support. We had the most amazing consultative team in the world. I love these guys who were going into the classroom at least once a week. We did a lot of professional development. And consultation and problem solving with teachers and showing them their own data and lots of different stuff. And what we found was that in low fidelity conditions, there was no difference between the programs. So that when they did not implement the program the way it was designed, or sort of when they were in the bottom half of doing that, there was no difference. And then when you look at the high fidelity conditions, there was a substantial difference. And this is change at DAS you can interpret, I think, as a change in IQ for our purposes. And there was a substantial difference between the STAR group and the structured teaching group. So this was interesting, and the school district adopted STAR now as its standard of care for kindergarten through second grade autism support classrooms, and we continue to provide support, and they're implementing it. But the thing that was most profound to me was this line. This is program fidelity. So we measured program fidelity on, let's say, a 1 to 100 scale. How many, you know, what percentage of the program components did you implement? And this is the average STAR fidelity. I'm sorry, this should be 69, not 49, or 79, not 49. But 57% was the average fidelity, and structured teaching was 48%. As I said, they loved our consultants. They were happy to have support. They thought the program was a good one. And on average, they implemented about half of it. Right? Now, we still got like decent outcomes. And maybe this is enough. right? Maybe they were making considered decisions, right? And I'll show you why I think that. So we looked, one of the things we did was went across the street to Wharton, our business school, and said, well, how do you guys think about this? Because they said, well, you have a technology, you have an innovation, you want to implement this innovation in a new setting, right? And so we measure what we call innovation implementation climate. Right, the extent to which teachers feel that it is that they are expected to do this, that they are supported in doing it, and that they are rewarded for doing it. And so we measured that in September, and then we looked at their fidelity in May, right, the next year. So we wanted to know in September if we measure your the extent to which you feel this is expected, supported, and rewarded, does it predict how you do it by the end of the year? And it turns out that there's a moderate correlation, right? And you think this is 9 months apart. We were 8 months apart. We were pretty happy with that. It suggests this is important. The thing that kind of blew me away, though, is this. This is these are the high climate classrooms, and these are the low climate classroom, adjusted for pretty much every variable that you can think about. In the high climate classrooms, the more you did the program the way it was designed, the better outcomes you got. Right? That makes sense, right? In the low climate classrooms, the more you did the program the way it was designed, the worse outcomes you got. Right? So who are these guys? These are teachers who say, yes, this is expected, supported, rewarded, and I'm going to do it the way it's designed. Right? And they do very well. These are teachers who say, nobody expects me to do this. Nobody supports me in doing this. Rewarded? I don't get rewarded for doing it. But you know what? Damn it, I'm going to do it anyway. Right? And they do it. And these poor souls, right? So in this environment where they feel remarkably unsupported, they're doing the program the way it's designed, and they're not getting good outcomes. Right? And what this suggests is that both these things are important. So these teachers are also very interesting to me. They're the ones who say, this is not expected, supported, or rewarded, and I'm not going to do it. And maybe they're making very considered decisions. Maybe in our very poor, very large school district, where these classrooms often have few resources, these are teachers are the ones who are saying, you know, this isn't appropriate for my setting, and there's something else I ought to be doing instead. And these teachers may be ones we have to learn something from. These teachers who say it's expected, supported, and rewarded, but I'm not going to do it, I'm not as interested in them. I am interested in changing their behavior. It may be time to bring back aversives. But, all right, so, and I say that completely in jest. But it has gotten us thinking about, well, what is motivating teachers to change their behavior or to not change their behavior? How do we think about this? And so we went across the other street from our building to Annenberg, the School of Communication, and there they study a lot about adult behavior change. And we've begun to think about what we are interested in as adult behavior change, right? The adults whose behavior we want to change are the teachers. And so they study things like exercise, and how do you get people to exercise, and how do you get people to use condoms, and how do you get people to stop drinking or stop smoking, and they have these very sophisticated social science and social psychology models to think about these things. It turns out it's really a very short hop from condom use to discrete trial training, right? And so we got very interested in thinking, can we take these models and apply it? Can we think that we have a behavior? The behavior, and I'll tell you how this changed, we first thought about, well, sure, we have a behavior. We want them to implement STAR, right? And what they say is most important is their intentions to implement STAR, and the intentions are affected by attitudes, norms, and behavior. Attitudes, it's a good thing to do, it's a bad thing to do. Norms, everybody's doing it, nobody's doing it. Self-efficacy, I know how to do this, or I don't know how to do this, right? And when you think about consultation and the way we consult, we often focus on this. Right? So if we consult with teachers, and our group did it as much as anybody else, you consult with teachers and you try and get them to do something, and they don't do it. And so what do? You give them more training. And you come back and they're still not doing it, so you give them more training. And the idea is that if they just knew how to do it, they'd do it. So since they're not doing it, it must be because they don't know how to do it. Well, I don't think that's it anymore. I think for a lot of them, it's about norms and it's about attitudes. And so it has us rethinking our consultation model. Maybe for some of them, it's skills, right? And maybe for some of them, and for them, if they're not doing it, it's because there are probably environmental barriers affecting their intentions, like they don't have the right materials or they don't have the right support or something else that we need to help them get out of the way. But it could be that they're very skilled, but it's attitudes and norms we need to focus on. And I'm going to talk a little bit about how we're doing that in a couple of slides. But one of the things when we talked to the social scientists and we said we want them to do STAR, and they said, "Well, what's STAR?" And we explained STAR to them, and they laughed and they said, "That's not a behavior. That's not even a repertoire of behaviors. That's an aspirational goal. What is it you want them to do?" And it took us a very long time going back and forth between the intervention developers and the social scientists to come up with specific behaviors that we were asking them to do. And we began to think about it within the context of this engineering flowchart, right? How do we make this as simple as possible? And this has become like one of my favorite slides in the world, right? Does it move? No. Should it? No. No problem. You are set. Should it? Yes. WD-40. Right? Does it move? Yes. Should it? Yes. Okay, you're set. No. Duct tape. And so now, think about it. Duct tape got the Apollo 13 to the moon and back, right? This is a very powerful tool. And so we're thinking about it got it back from the moon. It got up there on its own. But what's our equivalent of duct tape and WD-40 in autism intervention? How do we think about active mechanisms that are really the defining components of sometimes what are very complicated, comprehensive treatment models that we want teachers to implement? And this is sort of another thing, especially for parents, when you're talking about IEP goals and you're talking about addressing those goals, sometimes we tend to focus on something like, well, I want an ABA-based intervention for my child, or I want this comprehensive model implemented for my child. And what we've come to believe more and more is that that's not a useful metric, and it's not a useful concept in thinking about intervention. That we want to think about very, very specific things that we want done to help children in the classroom. And these are some of the ones that we think about. This is not, by any means, this is not comprehensive. It's not the be-all and end-all. It's what we've started to think about for what constitutes sort of fundamental basic instruction in these classrooms that we should be focusing on and that we can measure well. So here are the things we think about. We think about positive reinforcement. We think about a high praise to behavior correction ratio, and we think about using a token economy correctly. So those are two things we can measure and that can be implemented very concretely. We think about visual schedules to help kids organize their day, and frankly, to help teachers organize their day. We want visual schedules for teachers. Actually, I want visual schedules for myself. And so getting them up on the wall and getting teachers using them correctly. We want them to pull kids for one-to-one. And poor Miss Betty Ives Adams, right? So one of my favorite teachers of all time, and her assistant was out on medical leave all year, and so she's doing two-to-one, right? Because that's what she can do in her classroom. And incidentally, we had originally said do PRT, do DT, we don't care. And we'll help you with either one. As we've begun to dismantle our data from the STAR trial and look at what's important, it turns out that the biggest predictor of positive outcomes for kids when we look at classroom routines, discrete trial training, and pivotal response training is PRT. And so we find ourselves, and we think there are a couple of problems with this. It's not like we randomize teachers to discrete trial training or pivotal response training. So there could be lots of other things involved. But and we think that the teachers who take it upon themselves to really become good in PRT may be a special breed relative to the other teachers. But one of the things about PRT is the extent to which it can infuse the rest of the day, I think. And so it really, in some ways, it doesn't obviate the need for a lot of those functional routines, but it makes them a lot easier in a lot of ways. And so we've now begun to focus more on PRT than DT. So those are the four behaviors that we decided we really needed to focus on. And then we said, okay, well, if we want to put our money where our mouth is, let's find out whether teachers intend to implement these the way they are designed. Because if they intend to do them and they're not doing it, it's environmental barriers that we need to get rid of. But if they don't intend to do it, then we need to figure out whether it's self-efficacy norms or attitudes. So we asked them, and so, you know, it was interesting, we asked them about STAR before, and STAR, we just got a mush of stuff, right? That was kind of right in the middle of this. But then when we asked them about these four behaviors individually, we got very different answers. So 2/3 of them say they strongly agree with the phrase, "I will use positive reinforcement as evidenced by a high praise to behavior correction ratio over the next 4 weeks." So I don't know what's going on with that other third, right? But at least 2/3 say that they're going to do it. They strongly intend to do it, right? Visual schedules, about 58% say they strongly intend to do it. One-to-one instruction, about 40%, and they all hate data collection. Right? And so what that tells us is when we want to implement a program, first of all, let's start with the things they want to do, right? And work from there. And second of all, the strategies we use for getting them to do these things may have to be very different than the strategies we need. Or we may need to think about, well, how important is this? And how can we minimize data collection? So we're getting what the teacher needs and the child needs and we need, but it's really a minimal burden to the teacher. So, but these only matter if they predict behavior, right? It turns out that we looked at visual schedules, because visual schedules is the one where we can surprise teachers. Right? We can go into the classroom and the schedules are up or they're not, and the kids are in the middle of using them or they're not. Right? And so we went in and we looked at how well intentions predicted use of visual schedules. Teachers who said that they strongly agreed that they were going to use visual schedules were 6 times more likely to be using visual schedules when we did our spot check on them than teachers who did not strongly agree. This may seem obvious, right? This may seem like, well, duh, of course. Except that we as a field have not moved in this direction, right? This is sort of a fundamental concept that I think is missing a little bit from the way we think about training and supporting teachers in these environments. So how do we train? So what do we do then? If the issue is not skill, if the issue is not about professional development, and often it is about skill, and we worry a lot about pre-service training, and we worry, like we've been thinking about autism teacher boot camp. Like how do we get them for a week at the beginning of the year so we can really help them implement learn the fundamentals behind these interventions that will make our consultation more effective. But what if it's attitudes or norms? Well, we've been starting to think about behavioral economics, right? So this is, you know, Homer, who says he won't eat the donut because the donuts are way over here, so he'll have the fruit, right? But that subtle manipulations of the environment can make profound differences in the way that people act. And in fact, this is from a study of kids in a cafeteria, right? This is what this is making fun of, that if you order the food in the school cafeteria from most healthful to least healthful, then kids will eat more healthy food. That they take what's there first. So what's our equivalent for teachers? Well, a lot of people are thinking about this. This is probably the most, this is the book that really popularized the idea of behavioral economics and the idea that we can change behavior with these kinds of different, sometimes financial incentives, sometimes other incentives. The way that we've been thinking about it is we can't pay teachers more because the teachers union would not like that. As much as we'd like to incentivize them financially for doing that. And so how do we come up with incentives that are meaningful to teachers but relatively valueless? And the literature that we've turned to is the gamification literature. So at our last professional development or a couple of professional developments ago for teachers, I said, show of hands, how many of you have a Facebook account? And thank you. and all of them raised their hands. And I said, how many of you play Candy Crush? And 80% of them raised their hands. And then I said, how many of you are lying? And the other 20% raised their hands, right? These are extraordinarily engaging activities, right? And social media has really changed the way that we interact with each other, exchange information, and learn things about other people. And so we've been thinking about how do we apply that to our teachers. So we started a social media site for them. And right now we use the social media site to provide materials. They can share great lesson plans. We put up lots of icons that they can use for their visual schedules. We tell them about new trainings and put up videos and things like that that they can use. So we've just gotten them, and we started the social media site. We told teachers about it, and within a day, 60% of them were enrolled. And most of them, almost all of them, have enrolled now. The other part of what we've been trying to do is we have way more. We provide consultation now in 165 classrooms. And we don't have the staff to do it, and the district doesn't have money to pay us more to do it. And so we've been relying on FaceTime for remote consultation. And that has turned out, with our more experienced, it doesn't work with the new teachers. But it works very well with the experienced teachers who need some help with a particular student around a particular transition for their class or something like that. And then the third thing we've started to do is investigate data collection apps for iPads. Now, I will tell you, I do not like putting kids with autism in front of a computer. I think you've got a kid whose fundamental impairment is socialization. I don't think a computer is a good idea. But I love putting teachers of students with autism in front of a computer, right? I think that there's a lot we can do to leverage what they find rewarding about being in front of a computer to help improve instruction. So we have teachers who never collected data before, but you create an iPad app where they can collect data, and they start collecting data because there's something more rewarding about being in front of the screen. And so now our goal, and I'm meeting with your iPad group tomorrow, which I'm very excited about, is to integrate these three things. And so what we are trying to do is figure out how we create status by doing this. So for example, can you have a leaderboard of data collection for teachers? That teachers, you know, that you have the top three data collectors for that month. Can you have a badge system for teachers who pull kids for one-to-one instruction using PRT X number of times a week? Can we create levels of demonstration teachers, master's teachers? This came to me at a professional development where at the end of the professional development, one of the classroom assistants came up to me and said, "Where's my certificate?" And I said, "Well, we're not giving credit. We don't have, where's my certificate?" And I thought, certificates are important, right? And so now at every professional development, we give certificates. If you think about it, being a special education teacher is an extraordinarily isolating job. You are in a classroom with eight kids and an assistant in a school that may not want you, with a principal that doesn't necessarily know how to evaluate you, and few teachers outside of your classroom to whom you can go to for support. Right? And so part of what we're doing, in addition to the rewards and the certificate by these kinds of social media sites, and frankly, I think by our professional development, is creating a community that allows teachers to interact with each other in a meaningful way, to recognize that they're not alone, to benefit from each other's successes, and potentially to, in a friendly way, compete with each other for mastery. And so that's where we are heading in thinking about and thinking about instruction and changing teacher behavior.
That was great. I mean, really informative and very unique and innovative. So are you working primarily with the kindergarten classes or early classes? And are you also working with, I mean, one of the issues seems to be more and more children are in inclusive environments, they're in regular education, so then you have an additional complexity of not working with a special ed teacher, but working with a teacher who might be very, very well educated in all ways, except working with exceptionalities. So what's happening for you there?
So we're now in K-8 classrooms. So while our initial work was with the younger elementary school ages, we're now up through 8th grade. And Philadelphia has a very segregated system. Most of the kids who are in the autism category of special education, I don't know that that means it's most of the kids with autism, but most of the kids in that category are in these segregated settings. The more I watch these classrooms, the more I become convinced of how important inclusion is. That we are, in many ways, unintentionally warehousing these kids. And we often think that it's where they're going to get the best autism instruction. And so sometimes we push for that. But I think it's wrong. But it's been difficult to get the schools and the district to move away from that. The way that we've gotten them to move away from it is to plot for them the rate of increase in the number of classrooms in the district over the last 5 years, and to point out the expense associated with these classrooms. And so what they've done this year is given us two schools where we are doing whole school intervention. And we are trying this as an experiment to see if we can work from the principal down to the noontime aide to change the culture of the school to make it more comfortable for children with autism and more comfortable for the general education teachers who are working with them. This has been, it's been really challenging, and it's been really challenging to figure out how to provide consultation to the gen ed teachers in a way that doesn't pull them away too much from their classroom. And so we're still in the process of working on this. Where we've been more successful is with noontime aides and recess aides, and getting them to teaching them socialization interventions, actually borrowing from Connie Cassery's work, and teaching them those kinds of interventions.
And I have a question for you that's a little bit related, and this is kind of a lot of the folks here, you hear we have a socialization intervention program here, and I've always grappled with how do we take a clinic-based intervention program and bridge it to schools. Do you think there's any role for the two working together?
Oh, absolutely. So the first thing that I would suggest is stop testing them in the clinic and start testing them in the school. So when we have new interventions now, the first thing we do is put together a teacher focus group and find a school in which we can test it with our personnel in partnership with the teacher. And I think that this is a different model of intervention development. We've generally conceptualized intervention development as a pipeline approach. You have some basic science or psychological finding that leads to some clinical mechanism that we then test in the laboratory that then becomes manualized, that then makes it into the school. Right? And people have estimated that the gap between that beginning process and when it ends up in community practice is about 17 years. Right? If we want to circumvent or short circuit this extraordinary length of time, we need to start right in the schools. And so part of that is, you know, we do all of our consultation stuff at cost or at a loss. And we do it because it's our natural laboratory and these are our partners. And we now have an opportunity to do these kinds of things in a way that we wouldn't otherwise. Specific to socialization, schools have never accepted that social ability falls under their aegis.
I was wondering if the kids in your middle schools in Philadelphia, if they rotate for classes.
So Philadelphia has done away with most of its middle schools. So okay. They're almost all K-8 schools.
So.
And there is rotation, but it's a relatively limited rotation compared with what you get in a more traditional way.
Mm-hmm. Because I was thinking about your points that you mentioned earlier, you know, the schedules, things on the walls, positive reinforcement. And as the kids get into the higher grades, their challenges are just overwhelming.
So one of the things I've become really fascinated with and know relatively little about is this idea of self-appraisal. Right? So as kids are getting older and we begin to think about how do we generalize some of these techniques that are really teacher-driven, for those kids, can it be that the child takes it over in some ways? So can that visual schedule be part of a notebook that child takes with them? Can the child assess his or her own behavior in that notebook as well? And I've read just a little bit of literature on this, and I think that the field is kind of nascent, but this seems like a really ripe area too. And I see people who know more about it nodding, so I'm going to take that as a positive sign.
Yeah, hi. I have a really exciting comment, actually, to make. My son is on the spectrum.
Uh-huh.
He's in the fifth grade, and we implemented, because we have three or four intermediate autistic kids on our campus, and they've all been fully included since they've been in kindergarten.
That's great.
And one of the cool things that we've started is something called Circle of Friends,
uh-huh.
Where it does deal with the socialization aspect at school, and we get the kids on the spectrum together with typically developing kids twice a week. And they do little exercises, and they do more executive function now. This year we've added more executive functioning, things like how would we handle this situation and those types of situations with the kids. And we're finding it very successful. It is led by our ABA-trained classroom aides. We've implemented it there. We've been very fortunate. There's several families who have insisted to the district that we keep ABA trained aides with our children. And so they have actually come up with that program, and they are the leaders rather than putting it on the plate of the teachers. Teachers just kind of, you know, just let the kids know what the schedule is, and then the aides take over.
I have a junior faculty member, Jill Locke, who trained with Connie Cassery in some of these interventions and is now very interested. Her main focus is how do we train aides to implement these kinds of interventions. And what she's found is it's very difficult to get them to start. But once they start and see the immediate change in how children view them and their role, you know, it's the most amazing thing to watch an aide who has wandered the periphery or chatted with her friends, clearly desperate for a cigarette, move from that position into the center of social play with kids and how engaging that is for them. And once we can get them to do that, this is such an untapped resource. The what we disparagingly refer to as paraprofessionals, a word I've grown to hate. But these are the people who spend the most time with our kids, who I think in many ways have the most opportunity to make a change during the school day. I absolutely agree with you.
I was just curious, in the programs with the two schools that you're involved with, to what extent or degree are the parents or the family connected to that? Because we know that, you know, their climate and culture is just as powerful as the schools. So,
yeah, that's been a huge failure on our part. We have attempted many times to start strategies to engage families in the work we've been doing, and we've been really unsuccessful each time. We have, 80% of the kids that we're working with are on free or reduced price lunch. About 30% of them, English is not their first language at home. We are uncertain about the documented resident status of a lot of the families. And this has created a lot of challenges for us. I have a new postdoc, Ghazi Azad, who came from UC Riverside, who's exactly interested in this issue about consistency of intervention across home and school, and is developing a program, is borrowing another program called Conjoint Behavioral Consultation to try and do that.
There may be variabilities then in the family's support and involvement and connection, you know, with the child and their success.
Absolutely. No question. Our challenge has been to figure out a meaningful, sustained way to get these families to participate. And for some families, and it's often the families who probably need us the least, it's relatively easy. And for the families who need us the most, or we think need us the most, they may not think that, we've had the most challenges.
David, thank you. Great talk.
Thank you,
Sean. I was really taken with your slide about adult learning and about how to change the behavior of teachers to go beyond providing skills and, you know, take into account attitudes and norms. Sorry. I was wondering if you had any thoughts about how that might apply in other contexts, because one of the things I've been interested in my own work is how to get more pediatricians to do screening and to follow the American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines to screen at 18 and 24 months. And I wonder if you could think of any equivalents for improving that.
So screening is what do pediatricians do? They screen, they may refer, and then they never hear what happened, right? And so pediatricians are, there is no loop. There is no feedback loop at all. And I think one of the most straightforward ways to change pediatrician behavior around screening is to close that loop. And this is very challenging because of the different laws and privacy requirements of the different systems. But one of the things we've been working on in Philadelphia is getting permission for the EI system to then feedback to the pediatrician whether the family even showed. And if the family didn't show what the, if they did show, what were the results of the screening? And right now we're doing it by fax. We're hoping to be able to do it soon electronically. So I think that is like, without doing that, we are kind of stuck. The second thing is, if you want to change norms, you have to get pediatricians to think that other pediatricians are doing what you want them to do. One way to do that is to get them all in the same room. Another way to do it is to feedback benchmark data. And so one of the things we've been thinking about is, if you have a pediatric practice, can you norm what screening looks like at all practices? And you can often do that using billing data, right? And then you can say, here's the average of every other pediatric practice, and here's you. And that kind of data can be it's surprising how powerful that, I mean, it is the central component of targeted performance feedback. And so we've been thinking about some of those mechanisms as well. And people will screen just to get that number up, because it turns out that it's very aversive for somebody to say, here's everybody else and here's you. And that's all you have to say. So if I had to do two things to change screening behavior, that would those would be the two things.
Dr. Mandel, you mentioned that we are teaching people to be mediocre in a lot of things.
I did.
And given all of the vast array of interventions for autism, you know, some which are evidence-based and some which aren't, do you think that school districts and policymakers and others would do a lot better if they focused on just a few interventions at work and teach them well and encourage positive attitudes about implementing them, that we would be much better off?
Yes. I think that that is, I mean, I say these things sometimes to be purposefully inflammatory, but that is exactly what I think. And it gets back to this common element issue. That I think so many, especially these comprehensive treatment models, which are the ones that are sort of ostensibly developed for the classroom and that you can buy off the, I mean, part of the challenge is the proprietary nature of many of these programs, right? That they're licensed and the district is buying, is investing in them, makes it very complicated to implement and makes the potential for change too great, as opposed to saying, here are the few really important baseline elements that we need to implement. And then we can build on that, but this is what has to be in every classroom.
So I think I have a great question to follow that, because I was hoping really, I know you can't endorse or recommend a program, but I think as our public school is, my son's a sixth grader in a public school, fully included as well, but what public schools' delivery of the inclusion, the regular ed class, is all auditory talking at you. And so even though there's great skills gained by sitting there, the academic gap just keeps getting bigger. And I just didn't know if you had any successful programs of, you know, is there a better way to deliver? Are there models, are there programs that are better in that inclusion model, or is it always going to be you include them and you pull them out? Because they just want to push them to an SDC classroom when they get so far behind.
Right. What you describe is a huge challenge, and I think there are people in this room who are much better qualified to answer that question than I am about what happens in that general education setting. For the very young kids that, you know, that we spend most of our time with, most of the work is really sort of in their being able to participate in those classroom routines. And I have to say that the academics is a thing we've sort of, in some ways, honestly put on the back burner, which we probably should be focusing on. I don't have a good answer to your question. I'd be happy to talk with you about it more in depth afterwards, because I could certainly, you know, meander about it for a while. But like I said, there are other people here, I think, who could probably answer that better. I'm actually looking at Sally. She can probably give you a better answer to that question than I can.
Hi, Dr. Mandel. You've talked a lot about getting the programs to fidelity on the evidence-based practices that you targeted. I'm wondering what you have seen or used or what you found to be effective in maintaining that fidelity over time, and is it continued consultation, or what have you found to be sort of that sweet spot in terms of getting that maintenance?
We have not reached that sweet spot. But I think, so the consultation is absolutely necessary. One of the things that's been really interesting to observe, now that we have fidelity data over multiple years, is how much the fidelity drops in September. Even for our most experienced teachers, that they need that really serious boost in September to gain back what they had in May. We also see that it varies over the year. So fidelity is highest in February, and it is lowest in September and May, right? And so we realize that there's a cycle and a flow of the school year, and that our consultation has to be sensitive to that. One of the things that we have found works is to show teachers the best that they've done. And so over the years, we keep track of their fidelity on a monthly basis. And when it's dipping, we can say, you know, this is where you were. And we think we'd like to help you get back there again, or there are challenges you're facing that we can help you with. I think there are better ways to do it. That's the way we're doing it now. But I'm really interested in exploring it in more depth. But again, I think whatever we do, part of it has to be showing people their own data.
So I was wondering if you could elaborate a little more on the data collection part of this. I was in the schools for 5 years, and I know that can be a very tricky part. And specifically, I was wondering, in terms of giving the students their own data to look at, do you post that in front of the whole class? And if so, should we be concerned about a public shaming element of that if they're not doing well?
We don't, and we should be concerned about that, right? So we do not show individual student data to the class. The data is really for the data we're collecting. All right. We want the when we started, we had the teachers collecting very traditional data sheets, as you would see in discrete trial training and pivotal response training. We had them monitoring their responses to routines and the extent to which they could do them unprompted or with prompts or hand over hand or blah, 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 right? And this is, it's just so burdensome, right? And so where we are now is we're just doing probe data. And so you got 8 kids, and as even though they're the 8 kids you see all day, you just can't remember where they were yesterday or even that morning. You can't. I've got 2 kids, and I can't do it. And so the probe data is really a prompt for the teacher to know where to start, you know, where to pick up from where they left off before. And those are the kinds of data that we have really, when we come down to like really what's the minimal data. And my folks, you know, so I should say I'm not a clinician. You would never want your kid with autism to see me. Well, I'd maybe make them laugh. But I have these psychologists who are really very well trained autism interventionists, and they will argue with me about the data. They want more data, and I want less. And the data is not, we don't show the kids their own data. The way kids see their own data is more in their is more about response to successful completion of a routine or the use of their visual schedule. Those are their data, right? How do they make it through their day, and have they been successful in doing that? The other data, the more, you know, the extent to which they are improving on certain academic metrics or behavioral metrics, is really for the teacher.
The UC Davis Mind Institute was created in 1998 with a promise to find cures for neurodevelopmental disorders. Every day, our physicians and researchers come closer to fulfilling that promise. Their groundbreaking research on autism, Fragile X syndrome, chromosome 22q11.2 deletion syndrome, ADHD, and other brain disorders are helping children achieve their fullest potential. Please visit our website to find out more about current studies, upcoming events, and how you can help make a difference.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.